just logistics, we are going to continue on. We're going to have a full hour for the keynote. We will modify time later with breaks and whatnot. So we are not going to cut into keynote at this point. So
I will be very quick. It is my absolute pleasure to introduce my dear friend Courtney Carruthers and Jonathan Samuelson today. Courtney is a professor of fisheries in the College of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences at UAF. Her research involves partnering with indigenous communities to understand social dimensions of knowledge systems, climate change, subsistence livelihoods, and decolonizing research. Jonathan is Yupik and Athabascan from the Kuskokwim River communities of Bethel, Georgetown, and McGrath. He currently works for the Kuskokwim River Traditional or Intertribal Fish Commission. Yes, sorry. And Courtney and Jonathan have engaged communities, agencies, and organizations in discussions about indigenizing salmon biology and management across the state of Alaska. And I am so excited that they were invited by the Matsu Salmon Symposium to present to all of us today. So it is with great pleasure that I introduce Courtney and Jonathan.
Can we use both mics? Does that work? Thank you so much, Meredith, for that introduction. And yeah, thank you so much to the organizers for taking a leap of faith and inviting us. And I'm, just really humbled to follow such an amazing welcome from the indigenous tribes of this region. My heart and mind and spirit feel really full with this work. I just came, actually Jonathan and I both came last week from a tribal stewardship symposium up at UAF campus, where the chancellor announced the formal name of our Fairbanks campus changing to Trothieta, the lower Tanana Dene language for that hill that UAF sits upon. And so it was just really exciting to, anyway, get excited about some changes here. We're going to present this morning, and we're going to also host a dialogue to get a little bit deeper with some of our work this afternoon, so we hope you're able to stay for that. So I wanted to share, so this computer's not this, is that right? Anyway, okay, I have to advance this as well.
No, you should be able to use the...
Okay.
Is that turned on?
I don't know. Awesome. So I wanted to briefly share a little bit of an origin story for this project. And I see several folks in the room that are connected to one of these projects. A few years ago, there was sort of a think tank group of individuals and organizations called Salmon Connect that wanted to draw greater attention to equity issues within our salmon system in Alaska. And this think tank gave rise to several projects. The State of Alaska Salmon and People Project, anyone part of that project, Sarah, some others. Wilson, I want to acknowledge again, is such a leader in that work. It was over 100 indigenous and Western scientists coming together to co-produce knowledge about the State of Alaska salmon and people across time and across all regions. A really incredible body of work came out of that work. First Alaskans Institute, some of you may know, have been hosting racial equity dialogues across the state. Thousands of people have been involved in these dialogues in healthcare, justice, education, and they, through this work, started hosting some racial equity dialogues connected to fisheries. And the Alaska Salmon Fellows, I saw Danielle. Are there any other Alaska Salmon Fellows here? Oh, yes, another. Thank you. So there are two cohorts of salmon leaders across the state, really diverse leaders in all realms of the salmon system. Many of you may have heard of the Salmon Project, trying to bring life to some salmon stories and also to build unity. We often think of salmon as kind of a divisive, you know, we're fighting for allocation, this or that, but this idea that salmon unites all of us, no matter where we come from and our values. And then lastly, this Indigenizing Salmon Management Project, we gave life to this through the university. Sorry, I feel like it's advancing on this computer, but not this. Yeah. It shows up on here, but not that slide, so I don't know.
These difficulties are expected.
Oh, there we go. Okay, so they're on different systems. It's fine. I can just use this on the screen. Okay, that's fine. We got it. Thank you very much. So anyway, we gave rise to this project through the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Dr. Jessica Black, who's a Gwich'in scholar from the village of Fort Yukon and also Nanana, and myself, and Dr. Rachel Donkersloot, who's here sitting beside Wilson, led kind of fleshing out what this project could look like, and we're really excited that it's grown in terms of our team. We keep growing, and also our partners. So we wanted to start with the caveat that we have not done any work on this project in this region, and so it's with trepidation that we're sort of here introducing this work. We hope that over the next several years we can build relations and begin to do the work that the tribes of this region and other groups that are committed to this work want to do. We're trying to build local partnerships to help support work that's ongoing. And so anyway, this is just a subset of some of our regional partners that we've worked with across the state. I wanted to also talk a little bit about what brings us to this work. Why are we doing this? So there's two lines here. Does anyone want to guess what these two lines represent? Ah, of course. Blast. We're just nailing this technology here. Resume slideshow, maybe? Too many things going on.
That looks better.
Can you just try?
That's it. Yep. Perfect. Two lines. Sorry, Jonathan, I feel like I'm standing in front of you. Would anyone like to venture a guess of what these two lines or the ratio between them might symbolize? Yes. Thank you, Maria. More or less, yes. Thank you. So this line, the larger line, represents the 12,000 years that have been documented by archaeologists that indigenous people and salmon have been living together in Alaska. Likely it's much longer, time immemorial, as we heard earlier. The smaller line represents when Russian colonization happened some 200 years ago. I couldn't make a line small enough to represent the Euro-American colonization or Alaska statehood, so they're just really tiny little drips there. But yeah, the one of our major rationales in this work is that indigenous people have stewarded salmon for over 12,000 years, and yet we often in the non-native Western culture that's not visible, that's not acknowledged, and those systems of stewardship that have long sustained salmon, we really wanted to give visibility to those systems and learn from them.
Maybe I'll use this one, because I like to move around. So where am I on this? Here, in my short little life, working. But I'm lucky. I have a gift, because I have all of this knowledge with me. Every day. Sometimes I know it, sometimes I don't. But that's the gift I get from my ancestors. I came into this project sort of out of the blue. I met Dr. Black at UAF and some other people that were working on the Indigenizing Salmon Management Project, and they invited me to join, and I was very hesitant as I didn't feel like I was an expert in any of that knowledge. I didn't study it in maybe ways that people are used to studying things. And they assured me that all I had to do was be honest and tell my story. So that's what I'm here to do today, to share a little bit with you my story, my experiences. To start, I guess I should introduce myself. That means Weli Sagan, good morning, in the language of the people from my river. Thank you to all the indigenous peoples who have stewarded this land to allow me to come across the mountains to share a bit of our story and our history on the Kuskokwim River. I feel like there are many people in the room today who could have easily stood up here and taken this time too. Way up river. My name is Jonathan. I am from the Kuskokwim River. I was raised in Bethel. I grew up in McGrath. My family comes from Georgetown, in the middle, right in the middle of the river where the George River meets the Kuskokwim. So, this is the same river in all three pictures. Different communities, different places. Just to give a snapshot of the worlds that I came from. But this is my habitat. This is the natural world that raised me. With strong family ties to the whole river. I used to play on the tundra with my friends in Bethel for hours and days. We would climb trees in Georgetown, wandering through, getting lost, but not really actually lost, making our way back to the river because the river always led us home. And in McGrath, where I learned to hunt, to be a provider, all on the same river. But if you were to go to the places I played on the tundra, or those trees I climbed, you wouldn't know I was there. I didn't leave a mark. I didn't carve my name into a branch. We definitely didn't leave our popkins. Because from a young age, we're taught not what it means to steward the land, just to steward the land. We didn't know we were learning about stewardship growing up. And my people have stewarded this river, my peoples have stewarded this river and these lands since time immemorial. The natural world that raised me gave me everything that I have, and it's my life work to make sure I take care of that natural world, the land, the water, the animals, the salmon. We've coexisted for thousands of years. We depend on each other. We steward each other, the natural world that raised me, the salmon that taught me. And together, we sort of were moving forward in this work. And so that's just a little bit about me. But like I mentioned, there are several people in this room who are much more aware and have stewarded these lands. So I thank you again for allowing me to come and share parts of my story today.
Thank you, Jonathan. And yeah, I wanted to put up this cultural map of some of the territory of Alaska into Canada. And Jonathan comes from the rich cultures of the Kuskokwim, and we've heard from the traditional stewards of these lands. But all throughout Alaska, traditional stewardship has been taking care of the land and waters. And so really want to amplify how important it is to acknowledge that through land acknowledgement and respect, as we've already heard today. Another big motivation for this work came from the sort of stark realization of some of the inequities in the system, inequities that we've heard today, inequities that I think are very visible in Alaska Native experiences in the state and might be largely invisible to many of us non-Native people because our experiences are pretty different. And so sometimes we think about colonialism and the atrocities of colonialism, like genocide and child abduction, boarding schools, language suppression, cultural assimilation. as historic and in the past. And luckily, a lot of those more visible atrocities are in the past. But the systems that we have in place in the dominant Western culture sometimes perpetuate a kind of colonial mindset that I think is really important to sort of unravel, to peel back the onion layers and see how these things work. One of the major, you know, motivations, like I said, is that our salmon systems and all of the systems here in Alaska are traditional systems, they're indigenous systems, but yet there's been a marginalization from tribes as political sovereigns and knowledge systems from our Western system of science and management. So that's a big motivation. Dr. Black and some of her work in the interior, working with folks in Yukon River villages in times of the Chinook salmon declines and seeing the sort of criminalization and restriction of traditional fisheries and how deeply wounding those are, and that criminalization sort of ongoing and maybe again not visible if you haven't experienced it. And then my work, I came to Alaska about 15 years ago through the village of Old Harbor, which is a Supiak community in the Kodiak Archipelago, and learned a lot about the incredible knowledge systems of practice that exist in that region 8,000 years or so or more. But I also learned about the incredible dispossession that was going on and the really different stories that were told about why people don't have access rights to fishing anymore in those communities, to commercial fishing, but they're so linked to subsistence fishing in many of those villages. And so I feel like it's sort of become my life's work in educating and trying to collect data and help tell story on some of this stuff, because it's deeply unsettling when you learn about it. And so I have a quote here from our colleague Wilson, an eminent elder, Wilson Justin and Jessica Black. They wrote a foreword to our State of Alaska Salmon and People Project, an indigenous foreword. And so here says, Alaska Natives, despite their long-term relationship with salmon, have been largely left out of any decisions related to salmon management. This is unfortunate for the salmon, for salmon people, and the state of Alaska, who depends on salmon as a pillar of the state economy. The forces of colonization have been hostile to Alaska Native peoples and have led to our current situation, where we find ourselves in a position where our deepest relationships and expressions of spirituality are at times severed by limited or zero openings to live our way of life through the timeless exercise of fishing for salmon. Salmon play an important role today, as they always have, in the lives and cultural foundation of Alaska Native individuals, families, and people. Children are raised with salmon as a central presence, another relative, one which one must care for, share with, and most of all, respect. This timeless relationship has created a strong foundation, which until more recently children could depend on. Yet the current management system, which has largely disenfranchised Alaska Native people, has resulted in egregious dispossession of fishing lives, ways of life. Generational knowledge passed down from grandpas and grandmas, aunties, uncles, and parents are left in the shadow when there are no fish in the net, or worse, no net in the river, or the traditional sites no longer able to be accessed. Salmon give reason and meaning to life in a very foundational sense and teach children how to view the world from the lens of cultural values. I wanted to put up a couple more quotes again of the motivation for this work. The highly publicized case of former state senator and Tlingit fisherman Albert Kukesh is one example of the criminalization that's ongoing. So if you aren't familiar with this case, there's a quote here. In 2009, Senator Kukesh was given a citation for overfishing. And Kukesh, as a lawyer, wanted to highlight the injustice of what he saw as an unfair, and many people saw as an unfair, subsistence regulation that only allowed 15 fish per family per year in communities highly dependent on salmon. So he has a quote here, "I didn't do it to break the law. I didn't do it to offend anybody. I did it to challenge the premise 15 fish per year. That is 1.5 fish a month or less. Let me see any of you try to live a life of a whole salmon season, a whole winter on 15 fish, especially if you have a family of 5 or 10. I wanted to challenge that forever." And he talks in the later quote about some of the institutionalized racism that persists in our legal system and other systems. He won his case eventually, and his winning that case was sort of third or fourth page news, but when he got cited, it was all over the headlines. And so, again, just an example here of some of what we're talking about. This is a quote from some of our graying of the fleet, Dr. Donkersloot and I, from Bristol Bay in the Kodiak region. We're trying to understand and retell a story about why commercial fishing loss has occurred. And so this is a quote here. A local fisherman had been fishing in Togiak all his life as a drifter and a set netter. But then the next year came around, limited entry. He couldn't fish because he never got any of the paperwork, you know. A lot of people didn't speak English. English was a second language. Yeah, nowhere near accessible. If you didn't know how to exist in a Western paperwork world, you missed out. So this, again, to me and my work, interfacing between Alaska Native fishing communities and professors that I work with, fishery scientists and managers, it's not that necessarily there's any intention of dispossessing Alaska Native fishermen from their rights, but more a kind of a misunderstanding of how this system, the cultural systems that differ and the values that differ and the regulations that regulate fishing don't work for some people and they work for other people. And so we're trying to give more visibility to some of these misunderstandings. And before I pass back off to Jonathan, I wanted to note, again, a foundation of our work and a foundation of the kind of work I try to teach at our college is around cultural relativism, the idea that your culture fundamentally determines how you see the world. And there's many similarities across indigenous cultures, and they tend to be pretty different than Western European cultures that many of us are descended from. And in particular, common sense values that figure into our management as common sense norms aren't necessarily common sense norms in other cultures. So we have a couple words up here around across our work, the values of sharing and cooperation, stewardship and equity really underlie a lot of indigenous values and worldview and a sort of different kind of relationship between humans, right? That humans aren't superior to other beings the way the Western worldview situates us. And some of the values around efficiency and competition, conservation and equality may not fit well in indigenous worldviews.
In the summertime, my family gathers to fish. It really brings us together because we have migrated across the river and some to Anchorage and all around, but when it's time to work, you know, it brings us back together. We set aside any little rifts that we have in the family, and we know, like, this is the work that needs to be done no matter what. So we gather in Georgetown. Nobody lives there year-round anymore, where my grandparents had settled. So every year we show up and it looks like this first picture. And we have to work. We ready the land. We make sure the beach is ready. Check our fishing gear. Get the smokehouse together. Make sure we have wood to smoke the fish that we should receive. And it takes us a few days to do this. Because if we're not ready to show respect to those salmon, they're not going to stop there. We won't see them. The elders tell us, if your fish camp is not ready, you won't be successful that summer. I once called this fish camp, and I got an earful from my auntie, because it's where they grew up. It was their permanent, you know, year-round home at Georgetown. But I just wanted to talk about the work we put in to get ready for the fish as they're making their way back up the river. They've gone out to the ocean, they've grown, they've learned, and now they're making their way back home to serve their final purpose. Everybody has to help. Everybody has a role. These are some of my cousins' children. We grew up just like they did, doing these same chores, sitting under that same tree. And it's about family time, but it's about making sure the land knows we're there to respect it. So we did this summer, so that we can continue to enjoy this pristine little corner of the earth that my grandparents worked so hard to maintain, where my mom grew up, my uncles and my aunties, me and all my cousins. And every summer we do this. And we gathered this summer. Those pictures were from this summer, but we weren't getting ready to fish. We did all the same things, had the same family time, but we weren't getting ready to put fish away. My grandma died this year, and we gathered for a different reason. To honor her, her legacy, everything she taught us, everything she worked for. She lived a full life, and she was ready to go. But we knew we had to ready the place. The grounds weren't ready. The earth wasn't ready to return her back. So we gathered as a family, and we got ready, just like we would, as if we were going to fish. Because that same connection that you might feel to your grandmother or your grandchildren, that's the connection we have to salmon. That's the spiritual togetherness that we have with the land and the water. And I didn't realize it at the time, that we were doing all the same chores and doing all the same work, not to honor the fish, to honor our grandmother. But there was no difference when the day was over. We still sat on the beach, enjoyed the sunset, watched the river go by. And it's trying to tell the story of how that deep-rooted spiritual connection forms is really difficult. But I feel like everybody has a grandma at some point in their life. Everybody has a child or a grandchild. And that tethered heart that you feel, that's how we feel to our fish and our land and our water. So it's through this work now that I'm doing with ISM and at the Kuskokwim River Intertribal Fish Commission that we try to bring voice to that connection. But also we're bringing that long line of knowledge to the discussions that turned away from it for a long time. Because we can't afford to just let those discussions continue to happen without us. I would never let anyone have a discussion of what to do with my grandmother without me at the table. And that's sort of what brings me to the work of ISM with Courtney.
Thank you, Jonathan. Thank you so much. Moving along to our project goal here, in a sentence, we're trying to document the breadth and depth of these knowledge, indigenous values, knowledge governance systems across Alaska, connected to salmon, but as Jonathan mentioned, these holistic systems. And yeah, to use this knowledge and wisdom to improve the current science and management process system for all. We have a few guiding questions. So some of our work is gathering indigenous-led work through tribes, Alaska Native Organization, and others, partnering with communities to conduct I'll say a bit about our methods in a minute, but to conduct a sense of what values and knowledge and governance mechanisms in the different regions and the different communities are used and will help improve the long-term sustainability and equity of the system for all. We're also trying to do a lot of work on system change. We're assessing the current system from Indigenous perspectives, so gathering stories about how it feels to be at the Board of Fish or the North Pacific Fishery Management Council as a Native rural fisherman, things like that. And then, yeah, how can we better incorporate Indigenous peoples and values and knowledge and governance mechanisms into the current system or an alternative system that we may develop? So our work is really process-focused. Myself and Dr. Black, Dr. Donkersloot, Jonathan, all of our whole team are trying to reshape how research relations are built and to have this work be Indigenous-led, to think hard and carefully about the kinds of relationships necessary to do this work in a good way, and to connect to local priorities for ongoing work. And we are we have a growing number of students, Alaska Native students, that are part of our work carrying it out in their home communities and regions. And through this, we're able to mentor more students and also have the work be local. Our approach, we're trying also to draw upon Indigenous methodologies in our work of circle dialogues, multi-generational interviews, and also some cultural exchanges, and where we're bringing people to fish camp or to rural fishing villages they might not have gotten a chance to visit and teach them deeply about what these connections mean. So working on system change is scary, and this dialogue this afternoon might be making some of us anxious. This is a word cloud from our first dialogue we hosted in 2016 at the State of Alaska Salmon and People Workshop. I think it was the UA Center for Salmon and Society hosted that, and First Alaskans Institute helped us start a little bit of a dialogue on institutionalized racism and fisheries. And I remember one of the leads for that work kind of we were expressing some trepidation about getting into this, and she says, well, no one wakes up like super enthused to go have a dialogue on racial equity. Like, this is hard work. This is super hard work. But the point is that for Alaska Native people, they can't turn it away. They can just say, I'm not gonna go there. Whereas, you know, me as a non-Native person, I might not have to go into that conversation because I don't experience it. And so in our work, we're trying to build relation and realize that the Alaska Native, the institutionalized racism isn't an issue for Alaska Native people. We actually had one of our organizers for this first meeting suggest that if there was an equity and race issue in our fishery systems, the Alaska Native participants could have their own room to discuss those issues, as if the reasons they exist are not for all of us to discuss. And so that was really eye-opening. And also, we received a lot of pushback on the idea that there's even equity issues in our system at all. One of our organizers said, we have a state constitution that guarantees equality. Why would we need to talk about equity? So to me, this was a message about the invisibility of some of these issues, that we need to have more of these dialogues across culture, across place, and really build a shared understanding and share story. Some of the stories you heard this morning are really, you know, hard to hear, that traditional fishing grounds are not, you know, your people's anymore. It's heartbreaking. And we're going to try to host one of these today. I hope that you guys will be excited for that. The multi-generational interviews that we're doing have also been really eye-opening across the regions that we've been working in, the Yukon, Kuskokwim, Kodiak, Aleutians, and Bristol Bay so far. We're hoping to invite some work in this region and also Southeast. We haven't been yet able to do many interviews, but some of the questions that we've been asking about the relationships between salmon and people, how you learn to steward the land, what values ancestors taught you about taking care of salmon, of these relationships. This last question we asked a few of our partners to answer for this for our session. What do you wish that non-Native scientists and managers knew about your traditional lands and stewardship? And we posted a few of short responses that you guys can read throughout the day there. A lot of our initial work has been relationship building, and we're just starting to kind of get into the meat of some of the text data that's come out of our dialogues and our interviews. But it's already quite apparent in the work that Wilson, Dr. Steve Langdon, and others did as part of the SASAP project There's really shared values and worldviews across cultures, across indigenous cultures in Alaska, that salmon are like grandma. They're a non-human kin. They're a relative that are sentient, that have agency, that are in control. They can decide to pasture fish camp by or not. It's disrespectful to think that humans can predict, the return in advance of these respectful relationships. In the interview that Wilson shared with us for our project, he had an amazing discussion about how offensive maximum sustainable yield is from an Otna perspective. And I hope maybe he's going to offer some words in our dialogue and set us off on a good way. And so I think that he'll have a lot to share on that. This idea, too, that there's a moral obligation to care for the land, to maintain respect. Again and again, every interview that I've been part of, people talk about sharing as being the most important, one of the most important in fairness, the idea that you're not taking and you're certainly not wasting. The idea of and the hardship that comes from not being able to pass on knowledge and practice to the next generation. And, really hard interviews talking about a lot of, like I said, the colonial kind of trauma that happened and is still happening. And of course, these, when you're living with salmon and lands for 12,000 years, you're developing really complex knowledge about those systems, and you're managing them, you're stewarding them. So this is Brooke Woods, one of our collaborators on the Yukon River in her home region. Sometimes I teach classes on the human dimensions of environmental systems, and sometimes students will say, well, indigenous people didn't have to steward salmon. Their populations were low, or they didn't catch very many fish. And that's, blatantly untrue. A lot of archaeological evidence and population reconstructions of both people and fish suggest people could have easily destroyed the salmon systems in this place. There were, hundreds of millions of salmon being taken by a lot of people and being managed very carefully and stewarded. And so a lot of archaeological evidence and oral history and current practice around taking care of transplanting eggs, creating spawning habitat, removing beaver dams, controlling other things in the system. We hear a lot about preferential harvest, only taking male salmon, only taking salmon at this time. If one species is lower, switching species, and a lot of social organization built around these systems of stewardship, and they're deeply spiritual. And I think that's also something that is maybe not as well understood. For some of us, salmon is a job or recreation, but it's different if it's part of your being and your culture. So to conclude my remarks, I just want to sort of leave us with this larger work internationally going on to try to shift, research and education toward a kind of recognition of some of the, ongoing colonial impacts and indigenizing approaches. So you may hear this term co-production of knowledge. That's what we tried to do in some of the CSEP work, where we're pairing, not trying to validate indigenous knowledge with science, but pairing knowledge systems to think about things in a new way, the recognition of indigenous rights and self-determination and sovereignty, and again, beginning this hard work on the institutional change. That takes hard work, but we need more and more allies in that fight. So thank you.
Like I said, I grew up on the Kuskokwim River, which is far from here, but not that far. I moved to Palmer in high school for a very short while. I went to Palmer High School, lived across the street. There were no lights on the PW then. And so I've seen from a distance, because I do have family out here, how quickly this area has been developed and how it has grown. And I can't help to think that if I was here as a high schooler, navigating a school that had more people in it than my entire hometown. Hallways and corridors and double doors and all sorts of things that I wasn't used to. Highways and stoplights. What must that look like from the view of a fish? How do they feel now that so much has grown up around them? That their homelands now house a lot of other people. Intruded, maybe. Forgotten about. But I'm excited for today because I think everybody is here to do the work that assures that we haven't forgotten about them and the natural world that they lived in and that they grew up in and that we share with them. So these are some pictures of my family actually fishing. Everybody has a role. Everybody has a part. There's always work to do, no matter how big or small you are. I like the picture in the middle because my mom is in the green sweater and it takes five of my young male cousins to do the work she does. And the little girl on the end, that fish will be half dried and then frozen to eat later. But she's the youngest of five children, one of my cousin's families. They came the year before this to Georgetown. They're being raised in Anchorage. And we did all the work that I shared before to get ready to fish. And then we sat on the bank and waited because we weren't allowed to fish. We knew the fish were going by. We were ready. But we just had to sit there and wait. Because at that point, it had become illegal to practice our way of life. We were doing our job, protecting the habitat. But still, at that moment, they didn't have the opportunity to learn how to take care of the relationships we have with our land and our salmon. Which is so important because they are being raised in Anchorage, so their time out there is precious and it's short. And our families together, and this is what we're here to do. So I tell that story because in this, okay, management is just one tiny piece of our responsibility as Indigenous people. And it shows up in different ways, in cleaning and taking care of the land. And it's all part of this deep relationship that we have, this obligation we have. And we're facing many challenges that are forcing us to break that obligation. The habitat is changing. The waters are changing. Our way of life is being criminalized in some places. So that's where I think everybody can work together. Because in the end, we all have the same goal. We just have different responsibilities to that goal. We think about the idea of conservation. We are conservationists by design and nature. But maybe that means something different to us. To a lot of people, conservation is halting use, not accessing the resource to ensure it in the future. Yeah, that's what we want. We want to ensure it so that my little cousins and my nieces and nephews can continue that relationship. But to us, conservation and to many Indigenous groups comes through the idea of sustainable use. We have an obligation to maintain this relationship. It's a give and a take. And when we're forced to deviate from our way of life, which maintains that relationship. It threatens our use of that resource, that it won't come back. And like I said, it's not about management of a resource, really. It's about coexisting in a space that we share with each other, that we share with the water, the wind, which is always blowing here, the salmon. And how can we work together to ensure that Indigenous people don't have to break that relationship? Because when we're well and healthy in a system, that means everybody around us is well and healthy. That means our land is well and healthy. And our fish and our animals are here to give and share in this world that we're trying to save and maintain. They say our natural world speaks languages. We can talk to the trees, give our woes to the ocean. Our land speaks languages, none of which are English. So I was really thankful for the language lesson this morning. And I wanted to thank the people who welcomed us this morning for indigenizing the space. But rather, I'll thank you for reminding us that we are in Indigenous space. Always. And we're going to have time for questions, but what I tell people, we went to Russia and we met with a lot of Indigenous people over there who faced a lot of the same issues as us around habitat. And what I came out of that gathering, what I came out with from that gathering was, our lands speak our languages, our waters can hear us, and we're the best ones, the only ones that can think like a fish. Because we think with all parts of our being. We feel and we hear and we smell. And we know where we're at on the river and where home is. And we can think like a fish. So as we move into questions in the rest of the day and our dialogue later and tomorrow, I challenge you to think like a fish. Liana. I think.
Okay. And let's use the microphones for questions so that it becomes part of the recorded record of this piece.
Hi, is this on? Okay, this is Maria Coleman. I really didn't have a question. I really just wanted to share with you that what we learned from our elders is there's a passage through the mountains to the Kuskokwim, which was part of the traditional trade system, and therefore you are in the right place.
Please, are there other questions for our speakers?
Probably going to sound like one of those colonizing people that you referenced a little bit, but obviously the point of what you're trying to get across is that the Indigenous peoples and the Western culture peoples need to start working together to figure out how to make this work, integrating the two aspects into what hopefully would become an overall better management plan. But the reality of today is the white man controls what's going on, basically. And the system set up in this state involved the Board of Fish as the main regulatory body, working with the Department of Fish and Game. And Jim touched on it, Jim Sykes, in his introductory remarks. In this state, the individual has a tremendous ability to influence regulations for both fish and game, but it requires participation in that system. And I'm a member of the Mattoon Fish and Wildlife Commission, and we've been trying to figure out for several years, actually, even reaching out to an extent, probably not as much as we should have, but to the various indigenous peoples in our area, because we have a lot of shared concerns about how salmon to the northern district of Cook Inlet are being managed. And I'll mention it again. I've got a presentation tomorrow morning, and I'll mention it again if I don't forget. I do have white hair. But I would like to encourage the various indigenous groups, the tribal groups in our area, in your area, when the Board of Fish meets up for the interior, participate. Go in and tell those people what your thoughts are, why you think things need to be done. And things aren't going to change right away. It's going to be a slow evolution. But it's got to be started. And I think because there is a lot of commonality and interest, as Jonathan stated. I did get your name right, I hope. Yeah. We're all looking for the same thing, basically, and that is a strong and healthy and vibrant resource. But then the devil in the details is how do you start splitting what amounts to a resource that's fully allocated to all of the current user groups? How do you start splitting it up to accommodate perhaps a larger use by one group? Necessarily, you're going to have to be taking that some of that resource away from other groups. And how do you work on all that? And I just want to encourage, I'm not really asking the question as much as encourage I guess the term in Canada is First Peoples. And I don't know whether you folks would object to that reference for Alaska, but I would like to encourage you to get actively involved in the regulatory process, which involves attending Board of Fish meetings, getting involved with your local advisory fish and game groups, because right now they're the people that are running the show. And you're going to have to get, and I realize it's an additional burden for you to have to accept, because the establishment isn't going to give you anything, unfortunately. You got to get in and make your case and why you should have access to it. And quite frankly, we could use all the help we could get in our area from all of the different participants to try and convince the board to keep a few things the way we finally got them, as Jim referenced with this conservation corridor in Cook Inlet, to keep what we got and maybe even improve it, because there are user groups out there that have the traditional Western sense of greed and want everything they can get for themselves. And with that, I'll be away.
Thank you, Howard. Any comments from our guest speakers, please?
I mean, thank you for that encouragement. And I do see more and more that our people are working with the system that's in place. And it's encouraging to hear others welcome that. But I also believe in system change.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the commentary. I agree with it all, especially the nomination theory. I wanted to speak to an issue that is probably going to be difficult to correlate at the beginning, but it works on the basis of understanding of law. What you've seen here is part of a process we would call immersion. You're learning by immersion. What I want to speak to is a separate process, which is a question of the legality and standing. In the Constitution, tribes are mentioned up front. and always have been a part of the constitutional approach of the federal government. Inherent in that particular legal standing is something called the trust doctrine. Inherent in the trust doctrine application is navigational issues related to navigational servitude. Part of what we ran into in terms not only the Statehood Act, we being tribal folks, and also Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, and I want to stop at NGSCA. I presume that NGSCA has a meaning to all of you in one way or another. The Section 4 of NGSCA speaks to the abrogation of Aboriginal rights. It took away hunting and fishing rights. And it used that term Aboriginal. And it was like that because you can't use that term tribe in those kinds of legal building of what you would call rights. So Aboriginal was the term used in NGSCA. In the United States Constitution, it's tribes. So now we have a dual meaning set up at the beginning. Parallel lines never meet, as they say. I got involved in the Cato John case in 1977, something called the Pence versus Tuppy decision, which is unilaterally a rejection of the occupancy and use provisions of Native allotments. The Cato John case came into being as a result of her losing her Native allotment status by the BIA under Pence versus Tuppy, and it was reinstated. The original idea behind the Cato John case was to pursue the Reserve Water Rights Doctrine. Native American Rights Fund took the shortcut. They said, let's work on the question of individual rights of fishing based on past use on that section of the water within that Native allotment. In 1984, when I met with NARF, they said, why not go long term? Why not shoot for the big thing? There was a disagreement because I wanted the water rights doctrine, something I had studied extensively. Fast forward to ANILCA. ANILCA, at the beginning, was a promise to reinstate rights in terms of what we would refer to as subsistence. Not Aboriginal. Now, remember, Aboriginal was only mentioned once in Section 4. All of a sudden, all the discussion began talking about the tribals and tribal rights and the individual rights. ANILCA was put forward as Indian law, which caught a lot of us people who opposed ANILCA because it was so muffled on subsistence into the fold. And then it was later on decided not to be Indian law. This produced today, in 2019, a unique kind of status. We have on one hand failed law in terms of the intent of the Constitution. On the other hand, we have an operational law that embeds in the state of Alaska enormous authority, as was pointed out, in terms of regulatory process. To date, no tribe has yet tackled the question on a legal basis of the water rights doctrine, except for allusion by the Ninth Court in the Cato John case. In other words, the question of challenging the state's ultimate authority on a regulatory basis in waters of the state is still open on a tribal basis. Now, ATNA challenged the state on navigational servitude in 1982 to 1986, lost the case, did not appeal it to the Ninth Court, to the Supreme Court. Did not. So the navigational servitude question was thought to be settled in 1986 by the ATNA case. Navigational servitude does not in any way, shape, or form cross over to the trust doctrine issue on a tribal basis. So the whole question of what we're doing here in terms of the future is still open. That's why people like me are involved. Not because I think I've been wrong, not because I want to do right, or I'm not a crusader. I'm somebody who understands law better than the people who write laws. That's why I'm here. Thank you.
Thank you, Wilson.
Well, some really great thoughts for us to think about before our special session, our dialogue this afternoon. Let's give our keynote speakers another round of applause, please. And there's plenty of opportunities to visit with them as well. So just a couple of announcements real quick here. Remember this afternoon at 2 o'clock or around then, we have what's called a tidbit session. That's just short little three-minute announcements or maybe a project summary. If you do have slides you want to use for the tidbit session, please get them loaded up during the break and sign up also during the break. Just another reminder, there are still some seats available for the dinner tonight, so please register by the end of lunch. And then lastly, we are going to shorten the break, so please be back in about 15 minutes, so around 11:15, please. And listen for the bell to return to your seats. Thank you, everyone.